This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, and Burnaby. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC. Later today, Prince George artist Amy Blanding released a controversial single called Sunbirds, which cost her role at Northern Health and much backlash from the public. Ian Gregg is speaking to Amy Blanding for CFER News in Prince George today on The Scoop. And Burnaby City Council is looking into preparations for future extreme weather events. CJSF's Danny Nesvadurani has that scoop. CICK News spoke with the BC Cancer Society about a funding program to help those living with cancer with the costs for travel and appointments in the province. But first, Heather Watson from CHLY in Nanaimo is talking about an unsanctioned overdose prevention site which served Comox Valley Hospital inpatients for 5 days.
This is a CHLY and CVOX News update. On Monday, January 20th, Doctors for Safer Drug Policy, a group of addictions medicine physicians, set up an unsanctioned overdose prevention site at North Island Hospital, Comox Valley.
Overdose prevention sites, or OPS for short, are safe spaces where staff trained in overdose prevention and response are able to supervise people using illicit drugs, connect them to care, refer them to treatment, and provide harm reduction supplies, such as clean needles. By providing safe and sanitary materials, OPSs also reduce costs on the healthcare system by reducing cases of blood-borne diseases such as HIV and hepatitis C. This OPS being unsanctioned means it was not approved by the Vancouver Island Health Authority.
Doctors for Safer Drug Policy and their supporters arrived at North Island Hospital in Comox on Monday morning with hopes of setting up an overdose prevention site readily available for inpatients to utilize. One participating physician, Dr. Ava Hemerick, spoke to the media Monday morning from the boulevard just off hospital property.
We plan to be here Monday through Friday, 10 to 6, and to be at functioning OPS, where we are taking turns for shifts, and people can come in and use it for smoking or IV injection. So we're hoping that inpatients will be able to use it rather than going across the bushes or in the bathroom unsupervised and risk overdose, that they will come here with the support and be able to help them access care and treatment, potentially referrals and such. And I deal with prescribing opioid agonist therapy, which is an opioid replacement. So connecting them with care and giving them hope and making them feel cared for.
Dr. Hemerick and her fellow physicians are acting in response to halted plans for sanctioned overdose prevention sites that were set to be opened in 3 Island Health hospitals last year.
An article posted to Filter magazine in November 2024 revealed internal documents from Vancouver Island Health Authority that indicate while progress was made between September 2023 and April 2024, all work was paused in April due to quote-unquote government direction. This happened at the same time the province moved to recriminalize the use of drugs in public places.
In an emailed statement, Island Health said it was, quote, committed to ensuring patients who use substances receive equitable and accessible care, end quote, and said regional hospitals already had specialized addictions experts who, quote, develop unique and tailored care plans that meet the needs of patients, end quote, and went on to state that, quote, operating an unapproved clinical service or demonstration on Island Health property cannot be supported. This position is not meant to dissuade advocacy, but rather to ensure that all services provided on Island Health property adhere to regulatory, safety, and clinical standards, end quote. On Monday morning, when Doctors for Safer Drug Policy arrived at North Island Hospital in Comox to set up their unsanctioned OPS, the normally open grassy area within the hospital plaza was taped off with 2 Island Health Protection Services vehicles parked in the middle. The group was informed that they would not be allowed to set up on hospital grounds, as no unapproved clinical service or demonstration could be supported, and were redirected to the sidewalk where they would be outside Island Health jurisdiction. RCMP were also present Monday morning and checked in with Dr. Hemerick to ensure all drug use would remain within the tent of the OPS, away from the public.
You know, but this is how overdose prevention sites started in Vancouver, InSight. It was unsanctioned, but realized quickly how it was saving lives and giving people a place to turn to get care. And so we don't feel too badly about it. And we found a great spot. Look at it. You know?
The doctors, peer support workers, and community members who gathered in support had set up their OPS tent on the sidewalk boulevard, just in front of the taped-off lawn of the hospital. Many were now standing facing the road with signs encouraging empathy over stigma as drivers honked on their way by.
We always give two of each because the mandate is like never alone. And never
Among the small crowd were people with lived experience surviving drug addictions, some of whom now work as peer support staff at The Village, an addictions clinic that Dr. Ava Hemrick runs in Courtney. Teja McLucky gave the media a tour of the OPS tent and shared her perspective.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, the narrative that we like allow on TV and what we don't share. It's like heartbreaking. There's a lot of negative like press, and it was just, it'd be really great to see like, you know, someone like Eva or just like, there's so much good that they do. I mean, like my boyfriend would be dead if it wasn't for her. And he's a great dad, has a 13-year-old son, and there's just like, yeah, it's just life-changing what people do. So I hope this helps.
Tim Roth, the father of two survivors, shared the hope his children's recovery has brought.
Both my boys have been clean for over 2 years, and both of them are getting married this year. The first thing they did once they got sober was find girlfriends and then wives. It's great.
The doctors who volunteered at the unsanctioned OPS in Comox this week gathered from all over the island, from Victoria to Campbell River, organizing on their own time and at their own expense to provide care that they believe should be integrated into hospitals. Hemrick says that in doing so, they are putting their careers at risk.
It's a real challenge. Actually, we're looking at potentially one of the physicians are likely going to get fired for this involvement, which is unbelievable, abhorrible, really, that Island Health feels to silence in a way, but we feel so passionate. This is saving lives. It's saving costs, saving lives, and it goes above that. It's our code of ethics and, you know, Hippocrates' oath, you know, and what we swear by is to do no harm but to help people.
For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nazvararani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. On January 14th, 2025, Burnaby City Council passed a motion that directed city staff to plan for and mitigate the risk of extreme weather events, such as flooding and wildfire, in the Burnaby Official Community Plan that is currently being developed. While this is a decision that was made with the recent Los Angeles wildfires in mind, according to City Council, the planning for this decision had been months in the making. To learn more about what the planning and mitigation of extreme weather events in Burnaby would look like, CJSF sat down for an interview with one of the leaders of this motion, Burnaby City Councilor Allison Gu. During the interview, we asked Councilor Gu to expand on the planning and mitigation methods that the city hopes to implement, as well as the areas in Burnaby that are at highest risk if an extreme weather event were to occur. Please take a listen.
So the official community plan is every municipality's blueprint for the next 20, 25 years. So Burnaby 2050 is the name of our next official community plan. It designates the land uses and the densities of those uses for every parcel of land in the city. So it's a really powerful planning tool that municipalities have. The provincial government just changed legislation that essentially says that the official community plan has more power than previously it used to. And so it's a really important way to be able to set priorities for the future. And this motion was directing staff to make sure that we're mapping out where regional hazards are happening or are likely to happen because of climate change, such as wildfire and flooding, and look at how we can make sure that we're layering on appropriate land uses and appropriate densities where those hazards are going to occur.
You mentioned the pipeline there. I think maybe I could see one critique people having with, you know, a plan such as this, despite the fact that, you know, making sure there is preparation in place for climate emergencies is extremely important. There are still, you know, factors in regards to why this planning is, the reason the planning is being put forward is because of the increased prevalence of these climate emergencies due to, you know, ever persisting climate change. Is there plans in the OCP to also, you know, address more overarching systemic issues that sort of contribute to these increased climate emergencies?
Yeah, so unfortunately with those types of, you know, structures, they, one, are at a different level of government. So the city of Burnaby was in staunch opposition to the pipeline and the expansion of the project all the way through. But the federal government has jurisdiction over that and can override our powers. So we're limited in that sense. And then there's also limitations in terms of certain types of uses that are established grandfathered in uses. So we know that there's existing institutional refinery right alongside the shores. We know that there's the Trans Mountain Expansion Pipeline. The OCP changing that wouldn't change those uses immediately. So even if I was to say, this is a parcel of land that's a house right now, and I want it to be park or school in the future, when I designate that through the OCP, it essentially signals to the future what that will become, but it doesn't mean that the city of Burnaby is going to come and expropriate that land immediately. It doesn't mean any of that. And it doesn't necessarily at all change the market value of that house, especially if that land is going to be converted to a government ownership. They'll pay market price. So the OCP really, what it is important in changing is whether a property gets upzoned. And that upzoning is really kind of looking at how many more times people can live in this parcel of land. And what I'm saying is that, you know, that it's a very complicated process to be buying up properties that we know are at risk. They refer to that as managed retreat. This motion doesn't even call to that because we know we have a lot of questions to answer before we can realistically start to embark on those types of endeavors, such as funding. So what it's saying really is we shouldn't exacerbate the problem by putting a ton of people in an area that we know we're going to expose them to wildfire, flooding, other types of climate change induced hazards. And to take precautions in our kind of conflicting goals, because we have conflicting goals. We have a housing crisis. So we know we need to build more housing. We know we need to build dense housing. We know we need to build them in areas that are close to SkyTrain and transit. So how do we manage all of these conflicting tensions? Right now, thus far, we haven't necessarily put a language or addressed that tension and to kind of consider and balance those tensions, because we know in order to meet our housing goals, we'll, and if we don't build, you know, extra density in a specific area, then we know we're going to have to redistribute those housing units, those planned housing units elsewhere throughout the city. So how can we better plan for that? And where we can't redistribute those densities, how do we better create design standards that are required in new buildings so that people aren't exposed to undue risk for their property or for themselves? One example of that is for flooding. Historically, most, you know, high-rise buildings, larger buildings, they have their electrical units concentrated in the basements. And if we plan for, you know, a tower that is going to be in an area that floods, for example, the Still Creek area, right near Gilmore SkyTrain station, we know that those basements are likely going to flood. So we need to be creating requirements for that electrical equipment to be moved to the second floor or the third floor, and to look at ways that we can protect people, especially people whose you know, safety and like livelihood relies on the operation of electrical equipment.
Once again, that was CJSF in conversation with Burnaby City Councilor Allison Gu on the recent motion that was passed to direct city staff to plan for and mitigate the risk of extreme weather events in Burnaby. Thank you so much for listening to this piece. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also listen to this piece on frequencynews.ca.
My name is Carolyn Knox, and I'm the Senior Director of Access to Care for the Canadian Cancer Society.
Okay. So the Cancer Society has received funding to help people diagnosed with cancer with some of the more, I'd call these like auxiliary expenses that come with their diagnosis. Can you tell me what those are?
Certainly. Yes, we did receive some generous funding from the government UC that we administer for them. We provide financial assistance, which is travel grants for travel expenses related to cancer care for those who need to travel outside of their own communities. We also provide accommodations. We have lodges in Prince George, Kelowna, Vancouver, and Victoria, where cancer patients can stay for free, and they also receive meals. And we also have ground transportation in communities around the province, where we have volunteer drivers that drive patients to their treatment or diagnostic appointments.
Is this for anyone in BC, or do you need to like pre-apply? If someone is listening to this and they know somebody that this would be a really great service to, how would they go about doing that?
It's actually pretty simple. We have a 1-888-939-3333. Someone will pick up the phone and provide you with information and connect you with any or all of those programs that you can use. We have the Travel Treatment Fund, which is our travel grant program. There's an application form. The amount you receive is based on the distance you're traveling and your income level. But we provide support for people who have a household income over $100,000. So don't think that you will not receive some kind of travel support. And our accommodations as well, same phone number, and you get directed directly to one of our lodges where they can book you and in and tell you all of the details of our accommodations.
Okay. Is it the amount of kilometers traveled, or is that taken into account that there would be people who would be applying for this that are flying from, let's say, Masset on Haida Gwaii?
Well, actually, we do have a partner in Hope Air who does air travel as well. So you can apply with Hope Air. Again, you can still call our same phone number. Go to cancer.ca or call 1-888-939-3333, and we can connect you with Hope Air, who does provide free flights. Or we can set you up if you are on the mainland and want to drive to your appointments with our travel grant program. We can help you find accommodation. And then, of course, when you're in, depending on the community you're in, we may have Wheels of Hope program as well. We're currently recruiting drivers in Dawson Creek, Prince Rupert, and Terrace for our Wheels of Hope program.
Is there a limit where this program just, where you can't sort of tap into this assistance anymore?
Well, the travel grant program is currently an annual grant. We are looking at changing that, but for now it's once a year that they get that money. But the accommodations are available at any time. So anytime, if you need to travel once a week, if you need to travel once a month, once every 6 months, our accommodations are always available to you.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Local musician Amy Blanding joins us in CIFR Studios today in conversation concerning the upcoming release of her new single on January 31st. This is more than just a digital signal for your entertainment, although that may be a side effect. Sunbirds is a protest song, designed to bring awareness to the plight of all those affected by the ongoing incursion of Israeli forces in Gaza. Ms. Blanding is currently engaged in a lawsuit that emerged following a series of events which unfolded after her initial performance of this song in April 2024. Between then and now, Blanding was removed from her post as Director of Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility at Northern Health. Her colleague, Vash Ibadi-Cook, resigned in protest of her dismissal. Ms. Blanding sought legal advice and went public with her story. Since then, she has weathered a sustained flurry of online complaints and criticism, endured economic hardship due to unemployment, but has carried on not only as an advocate of Palestinian awareness, but also as a mother, a wife, and musician in the community of Prince George Clayley Tinay. And now, as of January 31st, the track which triggered this journey, Sunbirds, prepares to take flight. It's remarkable that through all this confusion and distraction that you were able to find focus again to pursue the release of this track.
Yeah.
Which was the original thing, circling back to it finally after several months and all that's happened to you. So this song has obviously changed your life in ways you likely never would have predicted. I'm gonna imagine that was probably not in your wildest dreams.
Nope.
What was your original intent when articulating this piece? Has that intention changed or evolved as you've gone through, you know, so many challenges since initially performing that track?
It is interesting. I wrote Sunbirds, and I write a lot of my music because I'm compelled to say something. Mm-hmm. I feel often the way I think a lot of people feel when they're hit with these huge things that they just can't understand or that they feel like they need to talk about or do something about, and they don't know where to put that energy or they don't necessarily have an outlet. I'm a musician and an artist, and I've chosen in that place to use that platform that I've developed and I've been given and that I'm privileged to have to share things and hopefully share them in a way that connects with people on an emotional level such that they never think about these things the same way again and that they feel compelled to talk to their community about or to make a difference or make a change. Since October of 2023, I haven't been able to sleep very well because I'm haunted by images of mothers like myself holding babies the same age as my little boy, wrapped in white shrouds, wailing, and like I have a visceral psychological reaction to these images. I can't not talk about them and I can't not express them through my art. That was always what Sunbirds was for me an opportunity to express my rage, but also to sing about a place that, from what I've read and what I've seen and what I've heard from Palestinian friends, is such a beautiful land, and it's filled with beautiful people. Now, with the song, I think is like it's definitely taken, it's become sort of a touchstone for me, and is probably the most important song I've ever written. And that's okay. I think art is necessary in times like this. It's important for us to have protest songs that we can grab onto, and, you know, it lights the way through the movement towards collective liberation. So if I can contribute in some small way to that, I'll feel really grateful. And if we can raise some money with the song as well, that will be just the best thing ever.
The amount of rigor that's been attributed to this song is fairly above average in comparison to your typical track.
Yeah.
As you mentioned before, it's really nothing new for you to be exploring, you know, a theme that's political in nature or that has to do with social justice or human suffering or really just observing the world around us.
Yeah, exactly.
So all proceeds of the track, Sunbirds, go towards Wear the Peace, an organization providing immediate care needs within Palestine. We're talking food, clothing, water, shelter, transporting people to hospital, immediate care, on-the-ground efforts, and...
as well as support to transport folks for medical emergencies and surgeries out of Gaza and then back in. All of the information about the organization can be found on wherethepeace.com.
Where can we find your song?
So it will be available on Bandcamp. So it's amyblanding.bandcamp.com. And I have to stress that you have to download the song off of Bandcamp in order for me to actually receive the funds to then donate to Wear the Peace. You can obviously go and donate to Wear the Peace yourself at any point, and I would urge anybody to do that. But if you are interested in the track, you can download it for $1 or $100 or $1,000. And any time that I get a ka-ching from Bandcamp that's related to someone downloading Sunbirds, that money will be immediately transferred to Murad from Wear the Peace. Thank you. There's been an immeasurable amount of support from this community for me over the past 8 months. Folks that some I've never met before and that I would never have known about if they hadn't reached out to me. Everything from emails and messages of solidarity to what can I do to letter writing campaigns to the Minister of Health asking for change, demanding change. Even folks who showed up at my house with a bundle of grocery cards. It's been overwhelming and beautiful, and I feel very, very held by this community. So I'll use this platform as an opportunity to say thank you from the depths of my soul. Thank you. And also, let's keep it going. Let Sunbirds be a catalyst for you. It's definitely been a catalyst for me. And let's see what we can do over the next year, because I'm currently unemployed, so I got a lot of time and energy.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, and weekdays at 7:30 a.m. in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.